All right, you can be turning in your New Testaments to the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 10. I'm guessing that there are many of us in this congregation who probably need this message today, because maybe you are tired for various reasons. And even if you're not one of those people that is tired, at the very least, you can look around you at those Christians around you who are in that boat, and hopefully this message is going to be encouraging for both sets of people. The ones who really need this, but also the ones who can be equipped to give encouragement and help to those who need it. It occurred to me recently as I was reading this book of Hebrews for one of my morning Bible reading sessions, that this book is, in its entirety, addressed to a group of tired Christians, or several groups, wherever they were. If you look at the title page of this book, it just simply says, "The Letter to the Hebrews." So obviously, it's really geared toward people who have a very firm grasp of what the Old Testament was all about. They're Jewish people who have become Christians. And for a lot of different reasons, some reasons that we're really not sure about exactly, they are really tired and weary. We do know that some of them are in prison. Some of them had been in prison before. Some of them are currently experiencing that. They're experiencing shame in their communities because they were embracing Jesus and those around them were not. And so we're verbally assaulting them in different ways. And so they had discouragement in their lives. They're not growing in their faith. And so how are you going to help people like that? Well, what the Hebrew writer does is he lays before these Christians their vision and their purpose and the plan that God was unfolding throughout time that they now stand at the end of. And so when you read the book of Hebrews, you're going to read about a lot about the tabernacle and temple worship and animal sacrifices. You're going to read about weird, obscure Old Testament characters like Melchizedek, this king of Salem that appears one time in the book of Genesis, and he's quoted one time in Psalms. What is that all about? Well, when you take a step back and you look at the picture of Hebrews, it's giving the purpose. Here's what God was doing throughout time leading up to Jesus. More than anything else, when you read Hebrews, you're going to find Jesus, because he stands as the ultimate sacrifice. He stands as the one who truly conquered sin and death and has given us eternal life. Some of the most, this is just personal opinion, but I think some of the most beautiful passages in our Bible talking about Jesus are found in this book, in this letter. So it's filled with perspective and exhortations, and it helped me so much when I pulled it out and read it a couple of weeks ago. And so I hope that it'll be helpful to you. What he's going to do in this letter is ultimately point us all to the coming city. In chapter 13, as he ends the letter, he's going to say, "For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come." And he's going to talk about people who had that perspective too. You remember Abraham in chapter 11? He left his city of Ur of the Chaldeans because he was seeking a city that has true foundations, a city that God has designed and constructed, not a city that he could find on earth. That's the city that we're going to as well. So what I want to do is I want to dig three shafts into this letter. There's a lot of different places that we could look at that will be encouraging, but I want to dig three holes in three different sections. And the first is in chapter 10. So I want to look at chapter 10 with you, starting in verse 32. We're picking up in the middle of a big thought, but hopefully we'll still get enough of this to understand what it's talking about. Verse 32 of Hebrews 10, he says, "But recall the former days, when after you were enlightened, you endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you had compassion on those in prison, and you joyfully accepted the plundering of your property, since you knew that you yourselves had a better possession, and an abiding one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. So what we learn from this is that the current struggle of these Christians is not their first struggle, that they have been down this road before, that some of them were thrown into Roman jails, and some of them were right there along with them through that experience. Unlike the jail system that we have now, in the Roman prison system, you are not taken care of at all. There were no three square meals a day. There were no extra blankets on your bed if you got cold. There was nothing supplied to you. You were completely reliant on the goodwill of visitors and family and friends coming into that prison and giving you what you need. Just like the Apostle Paul, in his second letter to Timothy, he says, I want you to bring that cloak that I left in Troas because I need it. It's cold in this jail. I need you to come and bring me my books, but also bring me some more clothes. So it was rough. It was really rough in a Roman prison for a lot of different reasons. But also you notice that they're suffering this shame. People around them are rejecting. Their possessions are being taken away from them. But look what he says about their attitude during that time, before, in the past. He says, you joyfully accepted what was happening to you and the other Christians around you. Why? Because they understood their purpose. They're going to a better possession that cannot be taken away from them. Remember Jesus said, don't lay up for yourselves treasures here, because moth is going to get it, rust is going to get it, a thief is going to break in and steal it from you and take it away. Nothing that we have here lasts. Nothing. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where none of those things can touch it. That's our reward. That's our possession that we're going to. And so verse 32, he says, you had endured a hard struggle. But in verse 36, he says, you have need of endurance. So endurance is not a one-time thing. In our Christian lives, we're not running a sprint. We're running a marathon. And so if we make it up over a hard hill, we can't say, okay, well, I did that. Check that box. I don't have to experience that anymore. This is something that is going to keep going and going until we cross that finish line. And so in chapter 11, it's no accident that chapter 11 comes right after chapter 10. Because in chapter 11, we have all of these different examples of Bible men and women in history who did this. He says, you have need of endurance. And then he tells us about Abraham and Noah and all of these guys who endured through all of their struggles to cross their finish line. But what he's going to say here is remember where you started from. Remember the beginning of the race. Recall the former days. Can you relate to what he's talking about here? Do you remember when you first became a Christian, how much joy you had? And how the different things in your life and the burdens that you had, they seemed lighter because you understood where you were going now. You had direction. You had purpose. You had perspective. You remember how thankful you were to form connections with other people who became part of a spiritual family with you, who were serving the same God that you were, who were tracking with you when so many other people around you were not. That's so encouraging. But do you remember at some point, for whatever reason, maybe practicing joy became harder for you? you remember maybe being much more interested in hospitality before than perhaps you are now? Do you remember the connections that you were grateful for before maybe are now not so encouraging to you as they once were because of our attitude? Do you remember things that you used to do for other people, things in this congregation, maybe even things in a public way? Did you used to preach sermons before in your life and now you don't? Or teach classes or hold little Bible studies somewhere with some person and then you don't do that much anymore? There are lots of ways that I think we can relate to this. And so what he's going to tell us is that you've got to go back and remember the fire that lit your bones as you first obeyed the gospel. That's what he tells them to do. Recall the former days. And we're jumping over to chapter 12 now, right after chapter 11, where he's talked about all these people who had persevered because of their faith and experienced all kinds of terrible things. In chapter 12, look at what he's going to say right after this in verse 1 beginning. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with, here's his word again, endurance, the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So you notice how he compares our Christian lives to running a race. Running races, really just running in general, is not my favorite thing to do. But I've known several runners in my life, so I have at least some understanding of how that works. And you know, when you start out on a race, you have energy, you have life, you have, it's easy to get out there and start doing it, and even if you run up a hill, you know, you can just bust that thing out and keep going, because it's early on, and you're excited. But at some point, as mile after mile goes by, you feel a little bit less fresh, a little bit less alive, and then the race becomes a matter of mental endurance. And when you hit mile 15 or 16 and you're trying to get to 26, what do you have to do? Do you just say to yourself, man, I hate this. Man, I can't breathe and my legs just are killing me and I just can't wait till I get my bubble bath? And you know, if that's what you're saying to yourself, are you ever going to get to mile 26? Are you ever going to cross that finish line? And maybe you will, I don't know, because I've never done it before. But it sure seems like you cannot run a marathon unless you are actively picturing where you are going and that finish line of crossing it and achieving that joy and satisfaction that you really crave, that drove you to enter that race to begin with. You got to have that in your mind or you're not going to make it. And that's what he's trying to give them here. Verse 2, what's the finish line? What does he say in verse 2? It is so important for these Hebrews and for us. The finish line, notice, is not just a place. It's not just a location. It's not a celestial mansion somewhere. What is heaven? When you boil it down to its essence, heaven is not just a place. It's a person looking to Jesus. And then he talks about who Jesus is. Jesus is the author and perfecter of our faith. Or he is the pioneer, some translations that you might be using say. Or he's the, and I love this, the trailblazer. You know, boldly going where no man has gone before. That's what he did. I mean, quite literally, right? Went into death, and then of his own power, he came out of death, out of his tomb, and appeared alive to his disciples and said, okay, now start the movement. Nobody ever has done that in the history of the world and never will. And so now he's sitting in glory, waiting at the right hand of the Father, and that's where we're going. He mentions that at the end of verse 2 there. That's where he is, and that's where we are going to be, sitting right with him. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 12, Paul said, "If we endure, we will also reign with him." So this strikes at the heart of the lies that the devil tells us. That, number one, this race just isn't worth racing. You know, maybe you entered it not really understanding what you were getting into, but now that you are crossing mile 16, mile 17, it's okay to just pull out now, because there are better, much easier races that you can run. This one is terrible. This one gives you shin splints and all these kinds of things that you don't need. No, Jesus says here, the race is worth running. Because I am at the finish line waiting to receive you. But then number two, this passage strikes at the heart of the lie of nobody understands how bad it is for you. Nobody really gets how much you suffer or I suffer. You know, we're going through this alone. Jesus says, I've run this race. I have endured everything that you are running and more. You know, we think that we have it hard in this 21st century, in this pandemic. And I don't want to take away from the genuine suffering that has happened and lost jobs and the lost family members and all of that. But if we consider ourselves imprisoned in our homes and consider that really tough, we've lost our perspective of what is true suffering. Because we can still turn on Netflix, and we can still order groceries from Instacart. We can still do all kinds of these amazing things that do not even compare with a real Roman prison that these people were suffering. And he even tells them, look, you haven't even suffered enough to draw blood yet. Did you see that? In verse 3, consider him who endured from sinners such hostility against God, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. And here's his perspective for them. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. So you've had it hard, but you haven't gone to a Roman cross yet. And so if he's telling that to them, we are even one step removed from where the Hebrew Christians were. We our suffering is pretty minimal overall in a lot of different ways. But the point is not to compare who's suffering the most here. The point is, whatever degree of suffering you're going through, here's where you look. Here's where you focus. Here is where you draw your attention to. It's to him who endures. So we've got all these examples in chapter 11, but do not make the mistake of just focusing on these men and women to the exclusion of this ultimate person who endured. Consider him, he says. And then the third passage that I want to look at this morning is picking up there in verse 5 in chapter 12. And we'll read down through 13. Chapter 12, verse 5. Have you forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as sons? My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor be weary when reproved by him. For the Lord disciplines the one he loves and chastises every son whom he receives. It is for discipline that you have to, here's our word again, endure. God is treating you as sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you are left without discipline, in which all have participated, then you are illegitimate children and not sons. Besides this, we have had earthly fathers who disciplined us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as it seemed best to them, But he disciplines us for our good, that we may share his holiness. For the moment, all discipline seems painful rather than pleasant, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. How powerful is this? So the third thing he says is, don't forget the exhortation. Now, what exhortation is this? It's the exhortation about what you are going through. Your discipline that is coming from God is for your good. It is doing something eternal with you and with other people's lives, such that glory is going to come from it. You know, when we go through a difficult time, what's our gut reaction sometimes to that? Isn't it to say, well, if God actually loved me, he would take away all these burdens. He would lift them off of my shoulders so that I don't have to be weighed down by this. And so the fact that this suffering is in my life is evidence that he doesn't really care that much. You know, notice how in this passage, that idea is flipped entirely on its head. What he's saying here is, the fact you're going through a hard time is actually evidence that he does love you. He does discipline you. And when we talk about discipline, that word just means training or instruction. It doesn't just mean punishment, by the way. It could include punishment, but in a greater sense, he is molding and shaping us to be the kinds of vessels, going back to our Ezra class, that he wants us to be. Now, the Father, he says, is going to do that to his Son, and he talks about the mentors that we all had in the text here. We all had that. We respected them. But they made mistakes, and they messed up sometimes. And if you're a father, you realize that you definitely do that as you try to shape and mold your children. Your imperfections just kind of mess up that process sometimes. But how much more shall we respect our Creator, the perfect Father who perfectly understands how to mold us in the best kind of way? And so what does he do? He leads us through this process that is temporarily painful. Notice how he talks about discipline here. It doesn't seem nice in the moment that you're going through it, but later you come out the other side and it does wonderful things. Yeah, do you remember back when you first started your job, or maybe you had a summer job when you were in high school or college or earlier in your life, and you walked onto the job site and you had no idea how to do something that you were expected to just get up and do? That was painful, wasn't it? When you're first being trained for a position or something that you know somebody's laying on you, it's difficult because it's exposing our ignorance about how to accomplish something. But when you go through that training, as difficult as it might be, isn't it so joyful to then have the satisfaction of then knowing, oh, I can wield that hammer, or I can manipulate that computer to do what I want it to do, or whatever it is. I can do that job. We are given that joy by God, but in order to have that, we got to not forget the exhortation that we are his sons and his daughters, and he is treating us this way, leading us through suffering in order to help us share his holiness, he says in the text. So something that I think we need to ask ourselves coming out of 2020 and coming into a new year, but still dealing with a crazy time in our culture and in the world, is how has God molded you? How has he shaped you? How has he changed you and me in our hearts and lives to draw us closer to him through this time? You know, because the language of our culture is just, well, 2020 was all waste. You know, I read a, I don't know if I read this article, but I clicked on CNN either yesterday or the day before, and there was a whole article that just said, like, the annus horribilis, the horrible year is kind of how our world kind of sums up what we just went through the last calendar year. Is that how you look at 2020? If we just kind of throw up our hands and say, man, it's suffering, it's hard, and I don't like this, and yuck, how is that going to help us? So how has God strengthened you? Have you allowed yourself to be taught by Him during this time? Or have we just simply regressed in our faith? Have we simply thrown up our hands? This is not what He wants them to do. So don't forget the exhortation, He says. It is for discipline you have to endure. And like we said at the beginning, I think all of this is leading to a final conclusion that He's going to get to at the end of the letter. So in chapter 13, verse 14, He gives us the picture of where we're headed again. He's already talked about it earlier in the book, but when He gets to that final place, He says, look, there is a city that we are running towards in our race. We will get there because, after all, every race, even if it's a really hard one, it always has a finish line. There's no such thing as a race that keeps going on forever and ever and ever. And so there's a city at the end of this thing, and it is a city that endures. Now, we have to endure in order to get to this enduring city, but it's not here yet. And so in the meantime, we draw strength from the fact that our Lord went through this before we did. He suffered horribly, not just in the physical kind of way. His body and His blood is what we're about to remember in this Lord's Supper feast. But even more than that, the suffering that came from bearing the consequences of sins that He did not commit Himself. Taking that upon Himself, so He says, in all these things that we talked about, recalling the former days, considering Him who endured, not forgetting the exhortation, it all comes down to this is the person that we are attaching our lives to. This is the place where we're going. And so at the end, in Hebrews 13, what He'll say around this verse is, Jesus suffered, it's Hebrews 13:12. Jesus suffered outside the gates in order to sanctify the people through His own blood. Therefore, let us go to Him outside the camp and bear the reproach He, here's our word, endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek the city that is to come. Therefore, through Him, then let us continually offer up a sacrifice of praise to God that is the fruit of lips that acknowledge His name. Do not neglect to do good and to share what you have, for such sacrifices are pleasing to God. And so what we're about to do in taking the bread and the juice and remembering Jesus is we're attempting to follow this command of offering up praise to Him. Because, after all, 1 Corinthians says, we proclaim the Lord's death when we go through this feast and take it together as a congregation. So I hope this encourages you as it has me. And let's keep pressing forward to this city that's coming to us.